It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a psychologist about a new poll showing that almost half of all Americans have experienced a stressful event in the last year.
First, Wisconsin is a fertile ground for writers, from Nicholas Butler's Shotgun Love Songs to Susan Gloss's first novel, Vintage. Stories from and about Wisconsin just keep on coming. Our next guest spent her childhood summers near Waupaca. While other families vacationed and kicked back there, her family ran its own mini golf course called Tom Thumb.
That course was a labor of love that only got more precious when the family was forced to sell because of rising property taxes.
June Melby joins us now. She's a former stand-up comedian turned writer whose work has appeared in McSweeney's and Utney Reader. Her new memoir tells a story of what it was like growing up, in a sense, on the Tom Thumb golf course in Wisconsin. Her book is called My Family and Other Hazards. June, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So Tom Thumb was the name of your family's mini golf course in Wisconsin. When did you realize that you were really going to miss it when it was gone?
Oh, man. You know, we knew it was inevitable that sometime it would have to go. I think most people realize at some point their family home will no longer be their family home. But it really wasn't until I heard the news that it just hit me like a ton of bricks, as they say. I was devastated. I really didn't want to let it go.
And you had your home. Your family lived in Iowa. Your parents were school teachers. But your parents, along the way, acquired this mini golf course in Wisconsin. Can you describe it for us? What was it like?
Well, it was really unusual because it was built in basically a large backyard. So there was a cottage on a street, or rather road, that had a lot of cottages, and there was some extra land, and the school teacher just built it there. So it wasn't on what you normally picture as a place you'd find a miniature golf course. It was on a lake. There were no other businesses around. There was no golf carts. There was no water slides. It was just cottages, 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 a miniature golf course. And so it was really wild. People were drawn to it. Especially when we turned the lights on at night, it was like lit up like Christmas and like moths to a flame. People were sucked in from all over the area to hang out there.
And this was in Waupaca?
This is Waupaca.
Well, it's not every family that has their own mini golf course.
No. What a funny thing.
What is the backstory about how you guys ended up owning one?
Oh, man, it's kind of on a whim. My parents have always said, it just fell into our laps. Most school teachers in those days, and maybe still today, took jobs in the summertime because they needed to make some extra money. And we were just visiting the area. My grandparents lived in the area. And we played mini golf once every summer when we visited my grandparents. And then one year, there was a for sale sign. And they thought nothing of it. The next year, the for sale sign was still there. And then my dad went, I wonder what would happen if we did this instead of my selling encyclopedias door-to-door, which he was never very good at.
Well, at first, you and your sisters, you've got two sisters, you thought this was going to be fun and games, free golf every day, but the reality turned out to be pretty different than that. What was that very first day opening Tom Thumb like for your family?
Oh, man. The first day, well, that is the first chapter. I have a whole chapter about the first day because it was just really, you know, hilariously traumatic in a way. You know, it's, you know, every family, when every family gets together, Thanksgiving or Christmas, you have a story you tell about the uncle who fell off the roof of the barn or the time the car got stuck in the snow. The story that my family tells is about the first day because we didn't know what we were doing. We thought we were going to get set up and be open to business at 9, 10 in the morning. At 6 p.m. that night, our parking lot was still full of tourists trying to play mini golf, and we were running around trying to put it together. It was really wild to be stared at by people who are really unhappy with you, and you don't, you know, how does the windmill go together? We're missing a piece for the castle doors. It was pretty funny.
Yeah, what goes into putting a mini golf course together after the winter?
Well, as you know, Wisconsin has a winter. You can't leave everything outside all year round. So everything goes into the garage in September, and then everything has to come back out. And the hazards come apart in minimally two pieces My dad had this thing of where he liked to complicate things. So he made a new hazard. It was a gumball machine. You just put through it. There was no moving parts on that one. And that was seven pieces. So seven different pieces. So, and we had, unlike most mini golf courses, there were six hazards that had moving parts, like a motor that open and close doors. So getting those set up was time-consuming. It was, you know, the whole place was really, I don't know how to put it. It probably should be in a museum, you know, some kind of folk art museum. It was all a labor of love, handmade, so things fell apart, but were lovingly, strangely intricate.
And you and your sisters, you had to pitch in. You were full partners in this golf course with your family. What kinds of jobs did you have to do over the summer?
Oh, what kind of jobs didn't we do? I waited on my first customers at age 10, and I didn't think anything of it. It was just, oh, that's what I'm going to do now. And we didn't have a cash register that made change. You just did it in your head and made change with the money in the fishing tackle box. It's all very low-tech. But we, you know, it's funny because, you know, we were a family of very different people. Each of us was so different from each other. And, of course, there's some clashes and not too many conflicts, but, you know, there's tension. And then, you know, a bus pulled in, and there's 50 Boy Scouts age 10 swarming the place. And so, you know, suddenly everybody forgets what we were thinking about or complaining about before. And I can only compare it to, like, a swarm of locusts. You know, okay, someone's, instead of boarding up the windows, I'm taking the ticket booth, I'll grab the snack shack, we'll load up the pop machine and try to survive.
Yeah, this was your summer. Every summer, other kids were having, I don't know, summers at home, going on vacations. You guys were running a golf course, but it sounds like there were some perks. There was Wisconsin itself, and, you know, you learned the secret to perfect snow cones, for instance. What did you love best about those Wisconsin summers?
Oh, you know what I think? What's funny is that we were working so that other people could have fun. And when you're a kid, that's really irritating. I mean, that's really, really irritating because we couldn't leave to go camping or, you know, anyone who with a small business knows, how do you ever get away? And if the business is in your backyard, you know, it's impossible. But then as I grew older, I realized, you know, it was really kind of awesome to have people having so much fun in the yard. You know, you hear them laughing all the time, you know, in the house. You know, if you sleep too late, you hear people outside laughing to wake you up in the morning. And it was kind of, I don't know, I really came to appreciate that. You know, it wasn't like a dentist office, I'll tell you that. People were very happy to be there.
Why did your parents end up selling it?
Well, they got older, you know, and it's a lot of work. You know, 12 hours a day, 10 to 10, 7 days a week all summer. And just became too much. And none of us, myself or my sisters and I, could take it over. So it was a little bit like a family farm. It's like, who's going to take it over? Who can take it over? Who's willing to work that hard? So they had to.
Well, you tell the story of this family golf course in your new book. And it's interesting because in the book, you're not really on track to become a writer for most of this book. You were a stand-up comedian in Los Angeles. When did you realize that you were a writer and that this was one of your core stories?
Well, you know, funny, I was never really that person who thinks I'm a writer. Oh, you know, I'm going to be a writer at an early age. I kind of always knew it was a story that needed to be told, but I kind of hoped someone else would do it for me. You know, I pictured myself, you know, spooning on a couch somewhere, one hand on my forehead, telling them, and then my mom washed the money in the washing machine, and someone else would write it down for me. But, of course, you get old and you realize no one's going to tell your story for you. You got to just buck up and figure out how to do it yourself.
This was emotional territory for you. I mean, it was fun, too, but it was also emotional. What was it like writing about the things that you love so much, your family and Tom Thumb?
Oh, you know, it was kind of like the book itself, that there's times when I was really laughing and having a lot of fun. I mean, I got to write about summer. You know, this last winter, you know how dreadful it was. I got to spend a good part of every day just completely enveloped in a Wisconsin summer. You know, that's not a bad job. That is not a bad job. Remind me never to write a book about winter. You know, why would you want to do that? But, of course, it's very, you know, in order to have the kind of energy it takes to finish a book and then all the revisions and then all the edits and then the copy edits, you've got to have something you really need to be saying. You've got to be driven by that internal need to get it out there. And, of course, yeah, it was emotional. It was hard to realize, you know, I always thought I'd be a big whopping success and then I could afford to buy the mini golf course from my parents so they could retire in luxury, you know. So I had to really come to terms with the fact that I felt rather poopy. It wasn't life. So the only thing I could do was write a book about it. That's all I could offer them.
Did it make you feel like even though your family lost Tom Thumb, your parents made a profit, but they had to give it up, did you end up feeling like it was preserved in a way because of your book?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah, you know what? I don't think I thought that way while I was writing it, but now I kind of do. Like, somehow, you know, the book is in a way, it's not like a photo album, because it's got parts that are angry. You don't get in a family photo album, and there's parts that are, I don't know, saying the things that you wouldn't admit in a photo album. But, yeah, I kind of feel like I did capture it in that book, so that makes me happy. I think that's why it took me the years that it took to write it, because I really, really wanted to do the best I could to capture it. The good and the bad of it, you know, the struggle and also the crazy tourists with their beer hats and their soggy money and their swim shorts, you know, half-naked people wandering your yard. It was pretty wild.
June, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was fun.
That was June Melby. She is a former stand-up comedian turned writer whose work has appeared in McSweeney's and the Utney Reader. Her new memoir is called My Family and Other Hazards, and as of the book's printing, Tom Thumb is up for sale again. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, it's our Teach Me What You Know segment. Today, a lesson in how to start your own podcast.
But first, we're taking a look at a new poll from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health. They asked more than 2,500 adults from around the country about how stressed they are and what's causing them stress and how they're dealing with their stress.
The poll found that almost half of all Americans experienced a major stress event in the last year. One of the most common causes of stress is health-related problems.
Frank Farley is with us to break down the information from this poll. He is a psychologist at Temple University and the former president of the American Psychological Association. Frank, welcome back to Central Time.
You're delighted to be here, Gene and Veronica.
I'd like to start out with the basics. Why undertake a study like this now? I think all of us think that we're under stress, but hasn't stress existed forever?
Yes, it has. But, you know, it's like sort of taking the temperature, you know, the sort of emotional and motivational temperature of the nation, and it's probably a good thing to do every once in a while. You know, we do that for our own health reasons when we go see our physician. And I think at the national level, it's probably a good thing to do every now and then.
So tell me about that emotional temperature right now. How stressed are we?
Pretty stressed. We don't know whether it's going up or down. There's another annual poll conducted by the American Psychological Association that is somewhat similar to this NPR poll. And they claim that our stress level on average is going down somewhat, slightly, over the last several years. But we're still a very stressed-out nation. I mean, Veronica mentioned at the outset that almost half, 49% of this survey by NPR, report at least one major stressful event in the past year. Again, that was tend to be focused on health issues, death of a loved one, But overall, you know, not just one stressful event, but sort of average across the year stressful responses, we have a lot, you know, pretty high percentage of people say that they're stressed by a whole series of things. One of the really notable results in this NPR survey is the gender difference, with a substantially higher stress response from women than men across 10 different categories of sources of stress. 9 out of 10 were higher, self-reported, of course, but 9 out of 10 were higher with women than with men. And that's an important number, I think. You know, it's interesting that women on average tend to outlive men by several years. So it's interesting that they are also reporting higher levels of stress. And so that raises a whole lot of interesting health questions about, you know, longevity and the role of stress in our lives. Is stress all that negative or what?
Yeah, lots and lots of things to think about. I want to talk about that self-reporting element of it for a second. I haven't seen the survey question, so I don't know how they were written or anything. But it seems to me that if people are self-reporting this, everybody has a different threshold for stress, and they perceive stress in different ways and stressful events and so forth. Does your survey account for that, or how do you get at the nub of what really is stressful?
Well, that's a really good point, Gene. It is perception. And one group may have a kind of different perception of what stress is and what extreme stress is than another group. And it's very difficult to control that in surveys. You know, I mean, if they went in and physiologically measured stress, you know, some of the things that occur when you're stressed out are things like a fast heartbeat, a headache, stiff neck, tight shoulders, back pain, fast breathing, sweating, upset stomach, etc. You know, if we measured that physiologically in the respondents, in response to questions about certain potentially stressful events, we might be getting closer to the reality of the stress response. But your point that it's perception is absolutely true. It's perception, and your perception of a particular, let's say, the loss of a loved one, your perception of the stress there might be different than my perception of the stress.
Yeah, in fact, the survey, I think it was 1 in 7 people, maybe something like that, reported that they didn't have any stressful events. And I remember reading that, and I'm like, are you kidding? You know, I mean, really? But that's what they say, right?
That's exactly right. And, you know, there are people like that. You know, I study these kind of people. They're the thrill seekers and the risk takers. To them, you know, many stressful events are actually, they just turn it around and it becomes an exciting event. So was Evel Knievel a victim of stress? No. He enjoyed and was excited and thrilled by his death-defying stunts. And so, you know, people like that turn stress on its head and it becomes something more positive and motivating and exciting. But most people don't do that. Most people are, you know, are stressed in the usual way. The Evel Knievels of this world are unusual. But, you know, the number that was reported here was 1 in 7. You're correct. And that's a substantial number of people.
We've only got about a minute left before we have to take some time out for news. But for the people who did report those major stress events, not surprisingly, I guess, a lot of it's related to health, either their health or the health of a friend or a loved one.
That's correct. But one of the really interesting things aside from that is too many responsibilities.
Mm.
That occurred over and over again in different age groups, and particularly younger age groups. The kind of multitasking phenomenon. And, you know, we're in the age of multitasking, and we're in the multitasking millennium. And a lot of people are reporting stress due to too many responsibilities.
All right. That's a good place to leave it before we go to the news. We're talking to psychologist Frank Farley right now about the new poll on stress in the United States. It's a new poll that's been conducted by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health.
We're taking your calls after the news. Are you surprised to hear so many Americans are feeling stressed? What about you? What is stressing you out, and how do you deal with your stress? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. News is coming up next, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with psychologist Frank Farley about stress in the United States.
And we're taking your calls now. Are you surprised to hear that so many Americans are stressed? And what is stressing you out? How do you deal with your stress? Or are you stress-free and loving it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@wpr.org. And a question I have here, we right before the break, we were talking a little bit about this idea of too many responsibilities, and we also talked a little bit about health concerns causing stress. Frank Farley, what else causes stress for the Americans that you surveyed?
Overall, you know, sort of stress over time, that three factors that this NPR survey found were the following. Too many responsibilities. I had mentioned that earlier. I interpret that as the multitasking effect. Too many responsibilities, financial troubles, and work problems. The latter two, financial troubles and work problems, have consistently come up in prior stress surveys, and they still are near the top. The multitasking, too many responsibilities, that hasn't shown up as one of the top ones so frequently in the past, but it clearly is in the top group in this survey.
One of the things that we've mentioned a little bit in passing more than anything is this idea that the American aspect of it. Is there anything to that? Do you think we're under more stress or think we're under more stress than other parts of the world?
I don't know about that. We don't have a whole lot of international research that's valid research for such comparisons. The NPR study is strictly an American survey. The American Psychological Association surveys that they do every year, that's American. So it is hard to know. I mean, we are an extremely fast-paced culture. I don't think there's much doubt about that. I mean, here's one statistic for you. I believe that the current ratio, the total number of automobiles per capita in America, is still higher than any other nation in the world. So that sort of bespeaks the fact that we're a nation on the move, doing things, getting out there, you know, pushing the envelope, however you want to think about it. And we're a nation that is involved in change. We're constantly, if you think about the digital age, most of the inventiveness associated with the digital age is American. And so we're a nation that's always changing. And uncertainty and change can be huge sources of stress. You know, the unknown, uncertainty, you don't know what's going to happen, that can be a big source of stress. So I would project that maybe America is potentially more stressed out than other nations, but I don't have definitive data on that.
Well, we've got lots of listeners who would like to join in, so let's hear what they've got to say, and we begin with Chris, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for this program. I have an interesting perspective, including because I've just moved back after living in Europe for 13 years, and the difference in cultures between working to live and living to work. You know, in America, I think with the less holidays, there's much more of a culture of living to work, including with the financial pressures. And what I find fascinating, and I've used it in my own life, is mindfulness. And I was really surprised when I saw that mindfulness made the cover of Time magazine. And I think people, and I have friends who've done the same, and I'm working to teach my own kids how to use mindfulness meditation as a tool to find one center again when the stresses of life swirl around you. It's kind of like finding the eye of the hurricane.
Chris, that's a very interesting perspective. Frank Farley, what about that? Does that get back to that whole perception of stress, or is there something more that she is talking about there?
Well, it certainly gets to the perception of stress. It brings in, bringing in mindfulness at this time is very appropriate. Mindfulness is a popular tool. Meditation is also, and mindfulness meditation is. Some of the best research in the world is done in Madison, Wisconsin by Dr. Richard Davidson, who's been studying meditation, mindfulness, empathy, and so on in terms of brain processes. You know, he's had people like the Dalai Lama come to Madison and submit to MRI technology in Davidson's laboratory. But yes, mindfulness, meditation, relaxation techniques, these are all very desirable ways of approaching stress.
Annette joins us now, and Annette is in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
I am great. How are you? Stress-free, I think.
Yes, I am. I was going to mention to your man there that I don't have stress. I believe it's how you perceive life. And stressful people, tend to live a more negative style life. I kind of try to sail through life. I don't let things get me down. If it's something I have no control over, I'm not going to let it get attached to me unless I can do something about it.
So Annette, that works for you, but I have to ask you sometimes you have to be facing, you know, a difficult work situation or a personal situation or a financial situation. And even then, you don't let the stress get to you.
No, I don't. I absolutely do not. I can't live my life like that. It's kind of like my mom used to say, you know, if you sit and worry, it's like sitting in a rocking chair. You know, you do a lot of moving, but you don't go anywhere.
Annette, thanks so much for that, Frank Farley. There's one of the 1 in 7 that we were talking about earlier.
That's right. Annette is one of the 1 in 7. Well, a song that has a huge impact on my life is that wonderful Monty Python song, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And, you know, it's positive psychology, looking on the positive side, looking on the bright side. And, you know, that is a solution to a lot of stress. One of the things in my field, psychology, is we have tended to focus too much on the negative side of life in the past. And increasingly, going forward in psychology, we're trying to get people to focus more on the positive side of life. And that can be a great antidote to stress.
Let's take time for another phone call here. And Ralph joins us from Little Swamico.
Yes, I have one of the 1 in 7. So you're getting a lot of 1 in 7s, maybe because we're so unstressed that we can call up. I'm not sure. But I guess it depends, like, your definition of stress, because, like, I have sorrow if someone in my family is going through a difficult time or I've lost a loved one. I'm going to have sorrow, but I don't have any stress associated with that. And sometimes it concerns me because I think I come off to other people as not caring as much. You know, someone that's just totally tore up and stressed out about it, they give the appearance that they care, and someone that handles the stress, they give the appearance that they don't care. So, I guess I'm asking your guests if they've looked into that at all. and I don't know what I can do about it other than not worry about it and not get stressed about it.
There you go, Ralph. Thanks for that. Frank Farley, interesting point there. At what point does that lack of stress translate to other people as sort of a lack of sympathy or empathy or caring?
Yeah, it can. That is true. But, you know, in a sense, you got to be true to yourself and not jerk your personality around just to appear to be stressed out by something. You know, you can be deeply moved, deeply concerned, deeply empathic, but you don't have to sort of show, you know, extreme stressful responses just to show them. I think that the way Ralph is handling it sounds right to me, you know, and he's just being true to himself.
One of the things we haven't talked about yet is what the implications of some of these numbers are. You talked about, you know, the gender gap and just sort of the sheer numbers of people who have stress in their life. And in the field you're in, that has to mean something. Those numbers have to mean something. I'm not sure what it is. So as you look at them, what do you think?
Well, you know, my field is booming. Psychology is booming. Therapy is booming. There's growing evidence that therapy works and can really help people who are just stressed out. But, you know, it just bespeaks that we have a lot of stress out there. It's the only way to look at it. And but there are ways to deal with it. And one should not let one's stress destroy your life. That's, I think, the take-home message.
Well, that is a great place to leave it. Frank, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
That was Frank Farley, a psychologist at Temple University and former president of the American Psychological Association.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff of Space Shuttle Atlantis.
Familiar sound there, at least it used to be. On this day in 2011, the Space Shuttle Atlantis took off from Kennedy Space Center, Florida, for the 135th and last mission of the Space Shuttle program. Gene, I kind of miss those Space Shuttle launches. What about you?
You know, I do too, and I have to say I grew up in the 60s with the Apollo programs, and for us there, that was every liftoff was exciting. And when the Space Shuttle program came along in the 80s, it was the same sort of deal. And even with all the tragedy that struck the Space Shuttle program, there was always a feeling, you know, that something was happening. And so to see that program end, it marks a big shift in where space travel is going in America, space money, space exploration, all of that. And yeah, so in a sense, it's sad to see it end, but it's interesting to see what's going to happen next.
Right. We'll have to keep watching it. I always wanted to drive down to Florida and see it go up, and I guess that ship sailed or that shuttle sailed. Maybe around the corner, though. Who knows?
Yep. You can still see some of the shuttles. A few of them are going to be on display. They may be on display already. And that's one of the things, actually, I would like to see sometime is one of those space shuttles up close and personal.
Well, coming up, it's Teach Me What You Know. Today, we'll teach you what you need to know about podcasting. First, here's a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to a linguist about the many different meanings and uses of the word sorry.
But first, it used to be that if you wanted your voice heard, you distributed leaflets, you stood in the town square and yelled, or if you were lucky in the last couple of years, you had your own radio show.
Some new options, though, now that we're in the digital age, so why not start your own podcast? All it takes is a computer, a microphone, and hopefully something to say.
So for today's Teach Me What You Know segment, we're being joined by Scott Gordon, writer and founder of the Arts Extract podcast. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So let's talk about, you know, for listeners who might not know what a podcast is, let's start by defining our terms first things first. What's a podcast?
Well, basically, it's an audio and sometimes video, you know, basically a file that is, you know, distributed through iTunes or an RSS feed, essentially, or a SoundCloud page. And it's essentially like having your own kind of radio show or something like it, but the format is a lot more free and loose and can kind of be whatever you want it to be.
So how did you first get started doing your own podcast, and what compelled you to do it? I mean, a lot of people talk about this sort of thing, but what made you take that step from, you know what I'm going to do someday, and actually doing it?
Well, first it was because I just listened to a lot of podcasts and enjoyed them a lot, and I sort of started to realize that it was a format that had a lot of freedom, where, like I said, you can kind of make it whatever you want. And second, as someone who's done a lot of writing and editing, I wanted a chance to talk about the kinds of things I was covering in a little bit more of a loose conversational format. And podcasts are really great for that, because you can have a conversation and you can get a little more spontaneity and maybe a little more humor and have a little more fun with it. Whereas, you know, writing can sometimes be a little more of a cramped headspace kind of ordeal.
So it's different than a blog in that regard.
Sure. You know, or, you know, and in our case, and a lot of other people's cases, it can be paired with a blog or some other bigger, you know, package of media stuff that you're doing or publication.
So let's say there's somebody out there listening right now and they've got a topic, you know, fishing or arts or whatever it might be. They want to start their own podcast. Let's start with the practical part of it first. In terms of gear, what do you need to get yourself set up?
Well, I think having a pretty simple audio editing software is a good place to start. If you have GarageBand on your Mac, that's a good place to start. Although the more recent versions of it don't have quite as much support for podcasts, but it's still pretty helpful, still pretty easy to learn. There's also Audacity, which is a pretty simple free program. And there's other free programs out there. And as you get into the professional programs, obviously you're looking at spending more money. And then, you know, depending on what you have, you might want to get some inexpensive condenser mics and maybe a USB audio interface so you can run the audio into your computer, which sounds a little bit complicated, but when you put it all together, it's really not that expensive or difficult to get going with it.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize the microphone thing, because I've had people just try to record stuff on the microphones that come in their computers.
No, don't do
it. And they're like, why does it sound so bad? And yeah, you're like, don't do that.
It's going to sound awful.
It's going to sound awful. I mean,
and there's also workarounds with, you know, an inexpensive Zoom recorder or something like that. You can run that into your computer with a USB and kind of use that as a mic. And those are decent. And in your editing software, there's different things you can do with your levels and your EQ to kind of cut down the background noise.
But bottom line, you do not have to be a computer whiz. You do not have to be a gearhead necessarily. You have to have kind of a rudimentary knowledge of how to make this stuff work and a little bit of practice, and you're in the game.
Yep.
So let's talk about topics right now, because there are how many podcasts out there? Millions? Is that fair?
Thousands at least.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
There is a lot. So how difficult is it to build an audience, because there's so many places, it's so many shows about the arts, so many shows about this and that. How do you stand out from the crowd?
Well, it is difficult, because there's so much out there, and there's so many ways for things to find their way to people, and so many ways for people to find things themselves. And, you know, I think it does help to have a decent, you know, social media presence for your podcast, and make sure you're kind of getting out there and using that to converse with people and engage with people. And it's important to have a distinctive take on whatever it is that you're talking about, and just offer people something that's a little different from whatever else is out there that's in your same subject area.
So how do you do it at Arts Extract?
Well, I think we try really hard to know our audience and really understand the scope of what we're covering and who we're covering it for. You know, we're something that's pretty focused on the Madison area, so we really try to talk to a lot of people in Madison about it and try to focus on things that are hopefully, you know, relevant to Madison. And, you know, we try to connect with other people in the community who are interested in having the kinds of conversations that we do. And we try to have a distinctive voice and try to have strong opinions. And we try to, you know, put some of our own humor and kind of personal quirks into it. And I think that helps to stand out a bit.
And so how often do you produce a show?
For about a year and a half, we were producing it weekly. Now it's a little bit more sporadic, because we've kind of been putting a lot more energy into writing things that kind of go along with the podcast. It's more of a blog with a podcast on the side at this point. Right now, probably about twice a month, I'd say.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask a little bit about that development of the show, because a lot of times when you start a podcast, I think you sort of have an idea when you're first starting it. This is what it's going to be like. We're going to do this and that and the other thing. And all of a sudden, 6 months down the line, it's like, you know what? That's not going to work. Let's throw it out. How did it work for you? What was your development like?
Well, I think the more we thought about, you know, subjects for the podcast and the kinds of things we wanted to cover, you know, we kept having just more ideas that we thought would also be good to talk about outside of the podcast format. And, you know, we also wanted to have a nice balance between sort of the approach that you take when you're writing something and the approach that you take when you're really just having a conversation with a group of people. So I think it was a way to sort of, you know, expand the scope of what we were doing, but without having it all kind of crammed into the podcast format.
Now, a lot of podcasts, when people think of them, they think they're aimed at a niche, a relatively small group of people. And that might be true. But how do you know when you're successful in a podcast? Is it sheer numbers of people, the quality of the response you get? What if you send a podcast out and you get nothing back?
Well, I think that's a different measurement for anybody. You know, I'm sure there's enough people that can realistically make money off of it that I'm sure that's a measurement of success for a lot of people in this. And that can be valid. And I think... for me, I think it's sort of the quality of the response that you get from people. You know, do people seem to care about what you're talking about and what you're adding to the conversation? You know, and are people engaged? You know, I know in the kind of web, you know, journalism world, there's a lot of talk about quote unquote engagement metrics, which is, you know, which sounds a little kind of puffed up and goofy, but I think it does say a lot about what's important about what you're accomplishing with any kind of media venture.
So for somebody who's got they've got the gear, they've got the topic in their head, what advice do you have for them as they sit down to crank out that first podcast? And then I guess more importantly, when they sit down to do the second one after that?
Well, I think it's good to try to be your own best/worst critic and try to be honest with yourself about what you think is working and what's not. You know, really taking the time to self-edit is really important. And also, you know, make sure that you're doing things in a way that you're able to have fun while you're doing it, and that you're able to take advantage of the openness of the format. And, you know, essentially don't be afraid to try things or to put your own, you know, distinctive stamp on things.
So is it as simple as the rules are? There are no rules? I mean, are there some things you would caution people about just staying away from?
You know, I don't know. I think it's a good thing to take risks. And if you screw something up, then try to learn from that and go on.
And the worst thing that can happen is it'll be in the internet forever and somebody can always go back and laugh at it? Or
that's right.
So as you look ahead to the Arts Extract, where do you hope that project goes?
Well, we're basically going to be relaunching it in the fall under a new name, and it's going to again be somewhat more of a daily or mostly daily blog that covers, you know, Madison arts and entertainment. And there's still going to be a podcast element, but we're going to, you know, switch up the way that we use it and keep trying to be flexible with it. Because, you know, as I keep repeating myself on this, that's one of my favorite things about podcasts.
So given what you know right now, is the future of podcasting bright, or is it kind of a fad whose time has come and gone?
I think the future of it is really promising for people who can be enterprising and interesting with it.
That was a very diplomatic answer. Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Scott Gordon is the writer and the founder of the Arts Extract podcast.